this change is proposed is that there is some land in the valley, in the Willamette Valley, that was not determined by LCDC to be committed to non-farm and non-forest use, even though it was in relatively small ownerships. And the farmers believe that if it's as small as is stated here on lines 35 through 37, it probably is, as a matter of fact, impracticable to farm it, and it's unlikely that in ownerships that small it would be consolidated into a commercial farm or operation. To give you an example of the effect of that change, a planner from our organization went out to Washington County on Friday and looked at ownership maps in an area of the county that has been contested between Washington County and LCDC. There are approximately 40,000 acres in Washington County, principally in the Chehalem Mountain, the hills of the Chehalem Mountain area. The county has placed it in an AF20 zone, which does not technically qualify under Goal 3 as an exclusive farm use zone. LCDC has been telling the county that it has to change that zone to make it an exclusive farm zone. By changing the figure 70% to 50%, we went out there and did a looked at some of the areas and looked at the ownership sizes. We found that by changing the 70 to 50, the few areas we had time to look at, there was a fairly dramatic change in the amount of land that qualified. A very little qualified if the figure were kept at 70%. That is, looking at an area of 320 acres, if you said that 70% of that area had to be an ownership smaller than 20 acres, very little qualified. If you change it to just 50%, a substantial portion of those areas qualified, and they are generally areas in small ownerships and not in commercial farm use. So that's that one change.
On page 3, line 1, merchantable timber was changed to wood, and that was done at the request of a woodlot owner who thought that that would be clearer and more appropriate.
Well, Mr. Chairman, no. I think you may be doing some violence there. I'll leave it to your own judgment. But I think it's nice. Some people like to have definition, but there are certain terms that we use as a state of art, and I think that's one of them, and I just point that out to you. I'd be a little careful on. I think they're nice suggestions because it means something to him, but it may not mean a damn thing under the tax laws of the state.
I think that's a point where we'll take it.
Okay, lines 14 to 16 were deleted because that was not, again, substantial compliance was not intended to be dealt with in this bill. On page 4,
if you want to just explain the changes there on the next page, there's sub 4 there on it.
We're on page 4 now, subsection 4. This is a restructuring, I guess, that Todd, you did. The effect of it, this was essentially an amendment that Agriculture for Oregon proposed to the committee on the 25th of April. And the idea was in the initial bill that they proposed, they limited the lot of record treatment in marginal lands to those parcels that were created by or transferred to present owner prior to January 1, 1975. And they reflected upon that and found that it didn't solve all the problems. It left a lot of folks who had lots created by or transferred after January 1, 1975 in a tough position, without any apparent good reason for it, since this is going to be marginal lands and not EFU lands. So it was rewritten so that anybody who has a lot that was created by or transferred to the present owner as of the effective date of the Act would be able to build on it in marginal lands. The one limitation being that if the person has two lots together in the same ownership, they would only get one building right, rather than two or three, however many lots there were. So the effect of the change is to authorize more lots of record, more dwelling units on marginal lands.
Mr. Chairman, call it.
Could you explain, can you show me the, where the words are, the limiting words that say, but if you have two adjoining pieces, you can't do it?
Down on line 27, it says, only one lot or parcel exists when a lot or parcel that meets the criteria in this section is contiguous to one or more lots or parcels that meet the criteria in this section. On the effective date of this act, greater than possessory interests are held in those contiguous lots, parcels, or so on and so forth, held by the same person, relatives, spouses, or a single partnership or business entity, separately or in tenancy in the common.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
Again, how do we address these? Let's say these lots are meet this test, but how do we address them, whether we can really service them?
Well, Senator Day, the uses that are authorized on marginal lands, it's simply an authorization. If a local government chooses to limit lots of record because of the services problem, it can do it. The language that says that is on lines 8 on that same page. The amended goals may require local governments to impose more stringent density or use restrictions than those provided by subsection 1 of this section on particular areas of marginal land in order to protect wildlife habitat, watersheds, groundwater, or other resources identified in the goal, or to prevent inefficient or uneconomical extension of public services and facilities.
I got it. Okay, thank you.
On page 5, lines 10 through 12, we amended the bill to provide that not only would the plaintiff in a case bringing a case to that involves a hardship dwelling that is no longer where it's no longer a hardship, that the prevailing party could get his expenses and reasonable attorney fees, whether that's the plaintiff or the defendant. And it, as amended, it now relates only to temporary hardship dwellings. I think that was several witnesses commenting on that. On line 38, we removed the not to exceed blank acres. It just reads a life estate in a dwelling in a tract of land under and around the dwelling. On page 6, we tried to address some of the problems that the woodlot owners were raising. Felt that their problems existed long before the bill was written. And the bill originally wasn't intended to deal with them, but now it does. And Dick, maybe you could...
Dick, you want to take us through that?
Yeah. The existing statute does not authorize dwelling units in conjunction with the propagation and harvesting of a forest product. Most county zoning ordinances deal with that situation by authorizing them in spite of the statute, and there's never been a case that's been brought up to challenge that. But by including here on line, well, under A, a dwelling in conjunction with farm use or the propagation or harvesting of a forest product, the effect of that language is now to legitimize what I guess most counties do. You can now have a dwelling in conjunction with a woodlot. That's one of the changes here. One of the complaints that you heard about the initial language, the original language in this section, that is the criterion for a farm dwelling, is that the income test, $20,000, was too high, and that it authorized a temporary dwelling if the person could not meet the income test. There was a lot of criticism of the language because it seemed to suggest that, well, it seemed to encourage people to locate temporary dwellings, whatever they might be, in exclusive farm zones and then present the county with an enforcement problem if the occupant could not meet the income test. So this is rewritten to take care of a handful of problems. The woodlot problem, to eliminate the temporary dwelling situation and to change the income test. The way it works now is if you come forward and you want a farm dwelling, let's say you've got 22 acres and you want to plant blueberries. Previously, the language said you look at the average farm or part of a farm that produces $20,000 in gross income. Well, that language is obtainable by the county, but it's not immediately available to the county. We've changed that to $2,500. That is immediately available. That data is immediately available to the county. So the county could turn to the U.S. Census Bureau statistics and say, okay, your primary crop would be blueberries. Let's look in the statistics to see what the average parcel or the average farm producing $2,500 or more in blueberries is. And they look through the statistics and they see that it's 21 acres. Well, this person has 22 acres, so we'd get a building permit. Let's take another example. Let's say the person had 13 acres and was proposing to have an apple orchard. Again, the county can turn to the statistics and see the average farm or part of a farm producing principally apples and would see that the average of that kind of farm is 19 acres. Well, this person only has 13 acres. In order for this person to get a farm dwelling, it would have to do one of two things. Either plant the apple trees that would be enough to produce $10,000 in gross income at the time they're mature, or wait, plant the apple trees, and meet the income test. Come in and show the receipts. I have sold $10,000 worth of apples per year in two consecutive years. It gets away from the temporary dwelling situation.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Turkley.
Dick, don't you discourage better than average farmers in that case with that language?
Discourage better than average?
Yeah, I mean, if somebody can make it on 13 acres instead of 22, or 15, or something less than the average.
They would be able to here. In other words, if the average was 19 acres and you've only got 13, you would have to plant the trees and show that that would be capable. You know, you can get yield tables from the County Extension Service, show that those trees would be capable of producing $10,000 in gross sales per year at maturity. Or, let's say you're not going to plant perennials. Let's say you're going to plant an annual, wheat or grass seed or something like that. You just go ahead and plant it and sell $10,000 worth 2 years in a row, and then you come in, and even though you're under the average, you can get your farm dwelling. What this is it's a performance test, really. It prevents the county from having to take it on faith that somebody is going to do something. It says, show us. You do it first, and if you do it, then come in and you get your building permit.
Mr. Chairman?
Sir, Dick.
You mean they're going to, in other words, they're going to have to go to the area with no buildings on there and prove it to you first before they get a house?
Unless they're above the average. If they're above the average, it's presumed that they can do it. And they don't have to plan anything first. They don't have to produce any receipts.
Sir Cohen.
Okay, but if I'm planting new filberts, I can assume that certain rough general acreage, whatever it is, of so many trees per acre will eventually produce X amount of income.
Right.
So I don't have to, if I make the acreage for the average filberts, then I can...
You can go ahead and build without planting the filbert trees.
Okay.
If you're below the average, you'd have to plant the filbert trees first.
I think you've done, I like this a whole lot better than what we've
done. Mr. Chairman, how does the language on line 33, page 2, would relate to the income that you're talking about on page 6?
Okay. Senator Hurd, on page 2, line 33, that's part of the marginal lands test. The way that works is if someone wants to qualify as marginal lands, mm-hmm. either by being in small ownerships or because it's relatively poor soil, they'd have to show that their land, the land that they're proposing to be marginal land, has not been part of a farm operation producing $20,000 in gross income.
top? Down on the...
You through with this?
Yes.
Okay. On line 19, we made some changes that basically would just prohibit pay campgrounds. The language, parks, playgrounds, campgrounds, or community centers owned and operated by a governmental agency or nonprofit community organization, and then hunting and fishing preserves, which wouldn't be subject to the community. Line 21, we reinstated golf courses as conditional uses. They won't have to go through the exceptions process. That's an amendment that was voted on already. Page 7.
Okay, Dick, you want to run through the amendments on 7?
There are two principal amendments to what was previously in 237 on page 7. First of all, on line, starting on line 4, as it was proposed initially, there would have been a prohibition on non-farm dwellings, new non-farm dwellings in Western Oregon. You heard some testimony. The testimony that I recall was from Commissioner Peter Sage from Jackson County, who gave you some examples of non-farm dwellings that his board had approved on very poor soil, and to my mind made a fairly good case that in their EFU zones there are some class 4 and worse soils where a non-farm dwelling could probably be sited without doing substantial harm to nearby commercial farm operations. So this change takes away the prohibition on non-farm dwellings in Western Oregon and substitutes for it a different notion, and that is you can have non-farm dwellings in EFU zones, but not on the best soils, not on class 1 through 3 soils. You can have non-farm dwellings on class 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 soils, but not on 1 through 3 soils. The second change you'll find on line 8, new subsection 4. One of the criticisms of EFU zoning has been that it's overly broad and that there isn't adequate treatment for lots of record, that is, lots that were created before the enactment of the land use law or the enactment of the agricultural lands goal. The lot of record law from last session, 1981, was very narrowly drawn, and I think Marvin Gloge from Linn County said that in the entire state there were only a handful approved. I don't remember what number he said. It was something like 6 to 12. This language would open that door a little wider. It says that if you have a lot or a parcel that is 2 acres or smaller in an EFU zone, regardless of when it was created, as long as it was before the effective date of this act, you can put a single-family dwelling on it so long as you can prove it's not going to interfere with nearby farm operations. That's a significant step, I think, for the farmers to agree to. That is definitely going to have an impact on them. They feel, however, that it's an acceptable impact if there is a limitation on new non-farm dwellings on better soils in EFU zones in the state. The second part of 4B there, starting on line 15, and goes on to the next page, that's a process that a county would follow to deal with these existing parcels, 2 acres and smaller. It's written to make it most convenient for the county. The county would not have to hold a hearing to approve one of these dwelling units on a parcel 2 acres or smaller. The county would only have to notify the owners of farmland in the area and then wait for an objection to come in. There would not have to be a hearing. If no objection came in, the county could go ahead and approve it without a hearing. If an objection did come in, the county would hold a hearing. The only objection that a farmer could raise to it is the interference objection. Couldn't object to it for any other reason. That covers new subsection 4.
The same question I think that Senator Day raised. Does the county then have a right to, if you will, interfere on its own? They wouldn't. They don't have...
They don't have to use this.
They don't have to have a... Do they have any right to turn it down other than the fact that an adjoining property owner says you're interfering with my farm? That's it. That's the only option, the only reason they could have, as I see it, or am I not looking in the right place?
No, I think you're right. The county could... Well, the county has these are minimum standards. The county can write its EFU ordinance to be more restrictive if it chooses, and it would still be an EFU zone that qualifies for tax purposes. So if the county wanted to adopt into its EFU zone additional criteria to check the spread of non-farm dwellings, it could do so. For example, on page 7, line 18, in subsection 3, there it says, a proposed dwelling has to comply with other conditions, such other conditions as the governing body or its designate considers necessary. That's intended to authorize the county to establish septic tank regulations, setback regulations, flag lot regulations,
okay,
whatever it deems appropriate. It could do the same thing to limit dwellings, this lot of record provision as well.
Is that, we're sure about that?
You could add that.
I guess I'm a little concerned with that because the county doesn't set subsurface regulations. It adopts in conformance with DEQ, and I don't know that that's true, Richard, the way this is written. You may be right. They can set certain standards, but it says the governing body chooses not to do so, that being the county governing body, mm-hmm, in normal cases. We're talking about rural farmland. I don't know that they necessarily would be stopped, okay? I just don't know.
Well, I think that if you took what the language on line 18 and added it as a paragraph 4C, then it would be clear that not only under subsection 3, but also under subsection 4, a county could establish further standards, further criteria for locating these lots of record.
Now, let's try it again. I wonder if there are standards set by state agencies that could be complied with. Wouldn't that be the way to go?
I think it's understood, Senator Day, that they would have to comply with that. They can't build unless they can get a septic tank permit.
Well, can we? I'd like to have time, you know, work it out to make sure. I just want to make certain that in the process of granting relief for lots of record, we're not granting more than what anybody else would have to comply with. I just want to make sure that that's tied down. If we're going to allow it per se, then I want them to have that. And that would be my preference, at least, that we at a minimum add line 18 to the other section. And I think consider Dave's suggestions too. We need to check to make sure governing body means any state regulations that would apply to that.
Mr. Chairman, I would suggest we go back and tie that in with the section I'm looking for it right now, but we tie it in where it make it clear that they're going to adhere to all those standards, whether they're set by local or state government. I think you'd be a little better off there, Dick, really, on that, because it almost looks like you're granting, if they get this, they can proceed ahead without, if the governing body says it's okay. I don't think we mean that. I don't think you mean that, particularly where it comes to public facilities, okay?
Mr. Chairman, there are several planning directors in the room who could perhaps enlighten the committee on how counties deal with the application of state regulations in the context of the EFU, if there are EFU zoning ordinances.
Yep. down to section 6. Section 6. You want to also go through section 6 here, Nick. That's the last one.
Okay. On the following page, I don't know what that would be, page 8, I guess.
I know.
Doesn't mean much to us. Some of these pages, I lost the track of the numbers, but you'll stay with the section. It would help a lot, Dick.
Section 6 on page 8, right. Starting on line 31, there's a new sentence there. You heard testimony from Darrell Gerritsen, County Counsel for Yamhill County, that as he read this new language in subsection 2 there, counties that have acknowledged minimum lot sizes, even though their minimum lot size has been acknowledged, this language suggested that they were going to have to make findings that proposed parcels are appropriate for the continuation of commercial agriculture. Well, this sentence, starting on line 31, tries to deal with that situation. It says the governing body or its designate need not make the finding required by this subsection if the parcels created to be created by a proposed division are not smaller than the minimum lot size approved by LCDC in the acknowledgement process. Let me see if I can explain that. Yamhill County has a minimum lot size of 40 acres. It's been approved by LCDC. If someone comes in with 120 acres and wants to divide it into two 60-acre parcels, the county could simply approve it without having to make the finding that's required here, because the parcels are larger than the minimum lot size that's already been approved by LCDC. That's the effect of the sentence. The second change is just beneath line 35. Initially, Senate Bill 237 said would have prohibited parcels for non-farm dwellings. That has been changed here in this paragraph 4. If you can get a non-farm dwelling approved under the amendment that's been suggested, then you can have a new parcel too. It eliminates the prohibition on the creation of new non-farm parcels. Should I go over that again?
I just want to know why you felt you had to do that.
Well, I think you would find that in most cases where a landowner wants to get approval for a non-farm dwelling, they are generally doing it for purposes of selling the dwelling. They want to create a parcel so that they can sell the parcel and the dwelling. And so if you make the change back in 215, 213, sub 3, and authorize non-farm dwellings in certain circumstances, you should probably authorize the creation of a parcel under the dwelling.
But if we listen to the Jackson County people, they were not asking for a partitioning, and they did not want to be put in a position to actually exercise or split or go forward with a partition. And they felt that the location of a second dwelling on a parcel that was large enough to justify, meaning bigger than the minimum lot size of their EFU, was all that they wanted, unless they had some protection against people actually coming in and parcelizing to that extent, and that eventually either, you know, I guess I have some reluctance in sort of looking at the piece of legislation that might be promoting that or perceived as promoting that. I don't know.
I can't recall, Senator Cohen, in Commissioner Sage's examples, whether those non-farm dwellings were approved on existing small parcels or whether they were approved on very large tracts of farmland.
They were on large tracts of farmland primarily, as I recall them, and they were not tiny farms. They had not been parcelized, but they were putting one on each end of it.
Wait a minute, I think they were talking about, they were on large pieces, but they were talking about a parcel around each dwelling.
No, I don't think we asked them about parcelization. They said, I thought they said no. They didn't split them out. But I could do that. Sorry, I don't want to hold a committee.
No,
I just want to raise a concern that
okay,
needs
well,
to
I
be looked into.
Okay, I want to find out the start. Now, the other, just before I do that, the rest of the sections basically deal with the revenue.
These are amendments we've already adopted, I think.
Yeah.
From what I can tell.
7 and 8 are gone.
We took out several sections that we had adopted in earlier.
Oh, you did?
We deleted the...
The farmers' panel.
Panel and...
Farmers' standing, the EFU zones.
So you eliminate all the things that are awful.
We took those out all the time.
Okay. All right.
You got a non-awful bill.
You got a non-awful bill. Has a bad name. I'll tell you that, still. Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir, Dave.
Yeah. Do you want to move these amendments in concept?
What I'd like to know is find out, I realize you're doing it as a courtesy, and I appreciate that. I want to find out the other two members here, if there's any portions of those they don't want moved.
That lot of record, I think you're on some shallow ground, but you're going to engross this bill. You're going to amend it, engross it, give us a chance to look at it in whole. And I think you got some problems with that lot of record, but I think as a question...
The last part we were just talking about?
I really think that needs to be thought out a little more, and